It's the Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Hi, I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Julia Child was once asked if rabbit would ever be popular in America. Her response was, not as long as there's an Easter bunny. Well, if Australia has its way, rabbit's going to be on every table. The Aussies are banishing the Easter bunny because rabbits do serious damage to the environment there. So instead of the bunny, they're pushing the Easter bilby. Now, this is a cute, furry little marsupial with big ears and a pointed nose. It's native to Australia, and it's endangered. So with Easter status, it's going to be protected. And yes, its likeness comes in milk and dark chocolate. Stay with us. We've got more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. It's the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know, every time the season turns, we humans celebrate with holidays. Well, now it's cutting loose time. It's spring. And there are serious holidays like Passover, Easter, and such. But aren't you just yearning to toss those heels and sneakers and run barefoot through the grass and then spoon up some new peas and cream or eat tiny strawberries? Well, we've got lots of takes on spring this hour and the inspiration it does and sometimes does not bring on. Justin Horner is a graphic designer. Now, he lives in Portland, and like many of us, he's had a rough couple of years of late. Tough years, which seem to have finally been put to rest one day by a tamale and a tire iron.
This past year, I've had three instances of car trouble. A blowout on a freeway, a bunch of blown fuses, and an out-of-gas situation. They all happened while driving other people's cars, which, for some reason, makes it worse on an emotional level. Each time, I was disgusted with the way people didn't bother to help. I was stuck on the side of the freeway hoping my friend's roadside service would show, just watching tow trucks cruise past me. The people at the gas stations where I asked for a gas can told me that they couldn't lend them out for, quote, safety reasons, but that I could buy a really crappy 1 gallon can with no cap for $15. It was enough to make me say stuff like, this country is going to hell in a handbasket, which I actually said. But you know who came to my rescue all three times? Immigrants. Mexican immigrants. None of them spoke any English. One of those guys stopped to help me with the blowout, even though he had his whole family of four in tow. I was on the side of the road for close to 3 hours with my friend's big Jeep. I put signs in the windows, big signs that said, need a jack, and offered money. Nothing. Right as I was about to give up and start hitching, a van pulled over, and a guy bounded out. He sized up the situation and called for his daughter, who spoke English. He conveyed through her that he had a jack, but that it was too small for the Jeep, so we would need to brace it. Then he got a saw from the van and cut a section out of a big log on the side of the road. We rolled it over, put his jack on top, and we were in business. I started taking the wheel off, and then, if you can believe it, I broke his tire iron. It was one of those collapsible ones, and I wasn't careful. I had snapped the head clean off. He ran to the van and handed it to his wife, and she was gone in a flash, down the road to buy a new tire iron. She was back in 15 minutes. We finished the job with a little sweat and cussing. The log started to give, and I was a very happy man. The two of us were filthy and sweaty. His wife produced a large water jug for us to wash our hands in. I tried to put a 20 in the man's hands, but he wouldn't take it. So instead, I went up to the van and gave it to his wife as quietly as I could. I thanked them up one side and down the other, and I asked the little girl where they lived, thinking maybe I'd send them a gift for being so awesome. She said they lived in Mexico. They were in Oregon, so Mommy and Daddy could pick cherries for the next few weeks. Then they were going to pick peaches, then go back home. After I said my goodbyes and started walking back to the Jeep, the girl called out and asked if I'd had lunch. When I told her no, she ran up and handed me a tamale. This family, undoubtedly poorer than just about everyone else on that stretch of highway, working on a seasonal basis where time is money, took a couple of hours out of their day to help a strange guy on the side of the road while people in tow trucks were just passing him by. But we weren't done yet. I thanked them again and walked back to my car and opened the foil on the tamale. And what did I find inside? My $20 bill. I whirled around and ran to the van, and the guy rolled down his window. He saw the 20 in my hand and just started shaking his head no. All I could think to say was, por favor, por favor, por favor, with my hands out. The guy just smiled and, with what looked like great concentration, said in English, today you, tomorrow me. Then he rolled up his window and drove away, with his daughter waving to me from the back. I sat in the car, eating the best tamale I've ever had, and I just started to cry. It had been a rough year. Nothing seemed to break my way. This was so out of left field, I couldn't handle it. In the several months since, I've changed a couple of tires, given a few rides to gas stations, and once drove 50 miles out of my way to get a girl to an airport. I won't accept money, but every time I'm able to help, I feel as if I'm putting something in the bank.
Justin Horner is a graphic designer living in Portland, Oregon. Now, his story was originally posted on a message board at reddit.com. Now, if you want to pay it forward with your own tamales, check out Diana Kennedy's recipe for tamales filled with poblanos and cheese. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. You know, for some, the words Easter break equal beach, palm trees, and weird mojitos. Now, for others, including Dana Bowen, Easter break is synonymous with adventuring in new territory and eating what you cannot eat anywhere else. Dana visited Sicily in the week before Easter, and she reported on it for Savoir magazine. Hey, Dana, welcome.
Thank you, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Why did you decide to go to Sicily for Easter?
Well, you know, there's a real special energy to Sicily during Easter, particularly during Holy Week or Settimana Santa. It's sort of a time and place where you tangibly, sort of emotionally experience the connection between food and ritual and belief and culture, like really like nowhere else on the planet.
What is it like?
Well, you know, first of all, no matter where you go, whether you're in a small town or a big city like Palermo or Catania, you encounter these processions, these parades of musicians and people where literally everyone in town, from the school children to the mayor, is dressed in black, carrying these beautiful ornate statues that each of these processions marks a different stage in the holiday of Easter, in the week of Easter, be it the Stations of the Cross or Good Friday. And everyone comes out for these beautiful processions with their families and with their friends, and then before or afterwards, they'll have a great meal. So what you really experience during this time is the coming together, the feasting that the holiday is all about. And, you know, I will say something else that's so special to me about Easter in Sicily is that there's this sense of Easter being all about renewal and rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
And you see that in the food, of course. It strikes you that it must be more than a coincidence that at the same time, after a long dormancy of winter, you're seeing bits of green, you're seeing the tender artichokes coming to market, the wild fennel and the wild asparagus that are coming up on the roadsides. People are pulling over in their cars and hopping out and harvesting, you know, foraging these wonderful foods. It's this incredible synergy where the ricotta is at its richest and most delicious in spring. And, of course, that goes into all of Sicily's amazing desserts like cassata, the ricotta cake, which is rimmed in marzipan. And that's one of Easter's specialties.
So tell me, what did you eat?
Oh my gosh! What didn't I eat? We were really so lucky to be invited into so many people's homes. One of the most memorable meals was actually Easter meal in Ragusa with the family of a woman named Giovanna Cascone. And Ragusa is in the southeastern part of Sicily. And we arrived early in the morning on Easter Day, and Giovanna and her entire family had the outdoor oven, just blazing, and they were preparing bread. They made the most wonderful dish called scaccia. It's a bread where Giovanna made a very fine dough, and she rolled it out paper thin, so it covered the entire table, almost like a sheet. And then she slathered a sauce of tomatoes, and some fresh pecorino, and she just started rolling it up and kind of elaborately folding it until it was almost like a calzone, you can imagine. She baked it to a crisp, and it came out just as the most delicious dish. And she was also making things like lamb empanada, which is, you can tell from the word empanada, sort of related to the Spanish empanada. And that's sort of like a lamb pot pie. And all it was pieces of lamb with parsley and garlic wrapped up in a pastry dough and put into that same oven.
Oh, this sounds so good and so elaborate. I mean, holiday food can be in Italy, these incredibly intricate dishes.
Indeed. And you see that, of course, in Sicily. That's one of the things that makes Sicily so special, is this layering of history, of the Spanish, of the Greek, of course, the Arabic, and many of those culinary touches are elaborate and are very rich. At one point, I said to Giovanna, who had been cooking all day, and I said to her, are these Easter dishes, Giovanna, that you only do during Easter? And she stopped, and she sort of thought about it for a while, and she said, well, it's not that we only make these dishes for Easter, but Easter is such a wonderful excuse to make them and to remember them. And I just thought that was such a beautiful sentiment, that mm-hmm. here are these spring dishes and an excuse to get together with your family and make them again.
Dana, thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. It was a pleasure.
Dana Bowen is executive editor of Savoir magazine. Her Sicily piece appeared in the March 2011 issue. Now, that tomato cheese pie that she talked about, you can get the recipe. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. And another thing you're going to find in Italy right now are young dandelion greens. You'll find them here, too. Just open your eyes. Scour local weed beds and lawns. Now, you're hunting for the tiniest of the tiny dandelion leaves. And you want that size because they've got exactly the right amount of tang. Later, they can get nasty. Well, then you do a salad. Now, you balance out the snap of the greens with carrots. And you sweeten those carrots up by caramelizing them in olive oil. Then you mix the greens and, you know, the usual, the garlic, vinegar, but add some salted pistachios and some goat cheese. Now, this is the sort of salad that was given folks who felt under the weather. Dandelions are, to put it delicately, nature's way of clearing out winter stodge, a cleanse, if you will. Now, it's not a whim that the French call them pissenlit, and I'm not going to translate that. Oh, have a look at dandelion and caramelized carrot salad. It's right on the website, splendidtable.org. Now, we're going to be back with a new version of the Happy Meal and where to find a peerless rye bread. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You know those times, those meals that you have with people you really enjoy, and then the next day somebody asks, how was dinner? And you say, absolutely great. And then you realize the food wasn't anything special, but it was one of the best dinners you'd had in ages. Dan Buettner says that this is one of the secrets of lifelong happiness. And he's got the chops to back that up. He's a researcher and explorer who works with National Geographic. He culled the latest science on what brings us happiness in his book, Thrive, Finding Happiness, the Blue Zones Way. Dan's here in the studio with me. Dan, it's good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
So you've done the book on blue zones, which is about the parts of the world where people live the longest. And now you've done this book, called Thrive, which is where people are the happiest. So how does food factor into happiness?
Well, one of the big discoveries from this book is that the happiest people in the world interact about 7 hours a day. And they don't just wake up in the morning and schedule 7 hours of interaction. A lot of it happens to revolve around food and the rituals that surround food.
Right.
So you go to a place like Denmark. Denmark is the happiest place in the world, especially in and around Aarhus. And they have these long, dark winters, but a couple times a week, they'll create an environment they call hygge, where people will get together around candlelight. They'll sit at a small table. They'll have open-faced sandwiches they call smørrebrød. And they'll have pâté out. They'll have herring. They'll have cheese. And there's an interactive nature to it. And instead of just clinking their glass in the middle, before they drink, they always look each other in the eye. So there's kind of a human interactive element to the whole food ritual.
Where else do you see food coming into play, you know, in specific ways?
Yeah. So for Thrive, we found four parts of the world where evidence points where people are happier. So you go to a place like Singapore, and there is a ritual around something called the steamboat. There'll be a bubbling pot of stock, and people will put raw meats or sort of with their chopsticks,
right,
raw
yeah.
meats
uh-huh.
or raw vegetables, and it becomes an opportunity to interact. In northeastern Mexico, it's the carne asada, that beef or pork marinated in lime juice and cilantro, and people stand around and sort of make tacos out of it with peppers. They'll make a sauce out of serrano peppers and cilantro and garlic mm-hmm, and tomatoes mm-hmm. and wash it down with cold beers. And that very rarely will work ever get in the way with that carne asada. So there's this sacred time where people interact around that food.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about engagement. Sitting at a table, you've got to look people in the eye, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why else do you think that food is so central?
Well, I think there's an element to what we eat as well. It turns out if we start our day with a grease and meat-laden breakfast, bacon and eggs, we'll actually have less energy during the day. We'll get less oxygen to our brain, be more sluggish. So if you start your day with a food high in complex carbohydrates, omega-3 fatty acids. I assert that the very best meal to start your day with, if happiness is what you're interested in, you start it with oatmeal. Regular steel-cut oatmeal, slow-cooked, will actually help your brain get more tryptophan, which we know is a happiness hormone. And that omega-3 fatty acid is also a very good antidepressant. And if you put walnuts in your oatmeal, that makes it even better.
So that has the omega-3 fatty acids?
Yes. You start your day with oatmeal and walnuts, you'll be 20 to 30% happier all day long.
So, Dan, are you still doing any work with the Blue Zones, with places that people live the longest?
Well, Lynn, since I saw you last, I took a National Geographic team to a place called Ikaria, about 25 miles off the coast of Turkey in the central Aegean. And this is a place where people reach the capacity of the human machine, a higher percentage than any place else, reach a healthy age 90. And in fact, if you look at Americans, if you're over 85 years old, you have about a 50% chance of suffering dementia, Alzheimer's disease or vascular dementia. This place had no dementia. Zero people. We found every person over age 85. And you start to look at their diet and wonder if that figures into their extraordinary longevity. And we see two very interesting things. Number one, every night, these 90, 100-year-olds, they make a tea. And we had all these teas analyzed. They just go out in the bush and grab a handful of these herbs and make a tea. It turns out that every one of the teas was a diuretic. And if you go to the doctor and find out you have high blood pressure, the doctor will first prescribe you a diuretic. And we believe that lowering of blood pressure chronically throughout their life explains part of this healthiness.
Huh. Why else?
Well, they have a variant of the Mediterranean diet, very high in beans, very high in olive oil. Interestingly, almost no fish. None of the longevity diets of the world contain much fish, but a lot of beans. I think if I were to pick one food that was a longevity food, no matter where you go in the world, it's beans. And new research shows that when you eat a Mediterranean diet and then drink red wine on top of it, your stomach literally creates antioxidants. It's one of those 1 + 1 = 3 things. So, you know, we've all heard red wine's good for you, but it's important to not just, you know, slam it down after dinner or after work, but rather to have that red wine with the right foods.
Dan, thank you.
It's a delight.
Dan Buettner's book is Thrive, Finding Happiness the Blue Zone's Way. Now, for a jump start on happiness each and every day, start your day with breakfast barley. You're going to find it on the website, splendidtable.org. Jane and Michael Stern coined the term road food in the 1970s. Every week, their finds prove it's still alive and thriving. Jane, Michael, guys, what's the latest find?
Lynn, we want to talk to you today about rye bread. Great rye bread, because deli meats deserve great rye bread, and not all delis, even delis that have great meats, serve it on terrific rye bread when you want a sandwich. We recently went on a hunt for Saveur magazine to find the best rye bread in America, and I think we found some worthy loaves.
Well, first of all, how do you define a great rye bread?
We're talking about deli rye, and that's different from the really dark all-rye breads that you get that are more typical of Eastern Europe. Deli rye is more for sandwiches. It's a little lighter. It isn't all rye flour. It slices easily. It's got that glossy kind of crust. Most of them are what are known as corn ryes, meaning the bottom is kind of dense with cornmeal, and they're dotted with lots of caraway seeds. And most important, they have that kind of chewy sourdough essence inside that gives them real substance. You know, they're not lightweight at all.
So what did you find?
We found the very best in, of all places, Ann Arbor, Michigan. Guess where from? Zingerman's Deli, of course. You know, they have a whole bakehouse there.
Yeah, right, right.
And they make an old-fashioned rye bread, meaning that they each day they make maybe 900 loaves. Approximately 10% of those get mashed into the next day's starter. So it's very kind of intensely yeasty, kind of wild yeasty. And it's really dense. They make normal size loaves. They also make a 2.2 kilo loaf, which is this huge round loaf that is just a joy to hold and heft from the table.
That's 5 pounds of bread in one loaf. Lynn, do you know how we started this hunt for rye bread? I have to tell you, Michael and I were eating in some of the better-known New York delis, and we were getting wonderful corned beef and wonderful pastrami, and the alleged rye bread looked like beige Wonder Bread. I mean, Michael and I grew up, you know, back in the day when any decent deli served rye bread that had seeds in it and it had a tangy crust. Yeah. But there's been this, I don't know what it is, it's like the bagel problem, this kind of cheapening of rye bread. So we decided to go on a hunt for the good old-fashioned kind. It's so interesting, though, because you would think New York, where the deli is almost a holy institution, that's where you would find great rye bread. I mean, I remember there was a bakery on the Upper East Side called Orwashers that made rye.
Orwashers it's still there, and they actually do make a great rye bread.
So that's another place to go if you can't get to the bakehouse.
If you can't get to Ann Arbor. Yes.
And Barney Greengrass, the sturgeon king on Amsterdam and 80s.
In the 80s. They have a good 88? Rye. Zabar's has an excellent rye bread, too, with just tons of caraway seeds on it.
Anywhere else outside of New York other than Ann
Absolutely.
Arbor?
Yeah, actually in San Diego.
In San Diego at D.Z. Aiken's. It's a classic Jewish deli with all the Vienna meat products. Davis Bakery in Cleveland, Kaufman's Bakery in Chicago.
Oh, that was delicious.
These are all places that serve that traditional deli rye with the corn on the underside and that glossy crust, the one that slices very easily. One of my favorite places is Shapiro's Deli in, are you ready?
Yeah.
Indianapolis, where they bake their own rye every day and they cut it extra thick for their really good corned beef sandwiches.
Oh, that sounds good. We can go all over the country, wherever we live, gather up this rye bread, stuff our freezers, and we're done.
Stuff our faces.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Hey, thank you, guys.
Bye, Lynn.
Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Stern's latest work is Road Food, an update of their seminal work on Sleeves Up Dining. Now, you can get their finds of the moment right on the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our free e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Download some podcasts and register for our monthly book giveaway. Now, this month, it's the new vegetarian book out of England called Plenty by Chef Yotam Ottolenghi. We're determined to build you a library, so get registered, splendidtable.org. Heard the one about if you dream of a sandwich, it means that you're under pressure, but if the sandwich has a fish in it, then you're conflicted about religion? Dream analysis can get very silly. But I can't help being curious. What I want, though, is somebody who knows what they're talking about. Well, psychologist Veronica Tonet joins us. Now, she studies dreams, and she's done three books on them. Dr. Tonet, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So how should we look at our food dreams?
Well, I think that dreams in general are a wonderful thing to be paying attention to every night. And our dreams about food, just like every other dream, are speaking to us in a metaphorical language. So they speak in that language that we thought in before we learned how to speak, which is a language of images and feelings.
So this is sort of getting down to our instincts?
Yeah, in a way. What dreams tell us the most about is how we genuinely feel, so it's always a good idea to pay attention to any feelings you have around food in your dreams, and then to ask yourself, are those feelings that I need to pay attention to in my waking life?
So are there certain classic foods, though, that have classic meanings, like, for instance, an apple or bread or something on that order?
Well, sure. Bread, there are a lot of actually foods that are associated with religious symbols and things like that. But in general, individual dream images are always very, very personal. So a person who's had an experience with an apple, where maybe they reached for an apple and fell off a ladder, is going to have a very different dream about apples than a person who just loves to eat apple pie.
So how would you get down to what those meanings are? Can we do that ourselves, or do we need to go to you
No, I really believe that people can do a lot of work on their dreams on their own. And one way to do that is if you have an image in a dream, an apple, for instance, and you're not sure what it's all about, you can imagine it really, really vividly in your mind and then watch and see what it changes into, and it will always change into something. So what you're doing when you're doing that is that you're seeing what your own associations are to that apple, your own personal associations, and what its meaning is to you personally.
Very interesting. Are there triggers that you found that can actually have us dreaming about certain foods?
You know, whether or not you are hungry or thirsty when you go to bed has actually been shown in experiments going way back to the late 50s to determine whether or not you have food in your dreams or you're thirsty in your dreams. So in other words, if you go to bed and you're hungry or you're thirsty, you're more likely to actually dream about food or drinking when you're asleep. And the more vividly you have an experience of eating or drinking while you're asleep, the less hungry you are actually in the morning.
Really?
Mm-hmm. So people have actually been found to eat and drink less when they've had a really vivid, gratifying dream of eating or drinking something that they just are really enjoying at night.
Oh, gosh. Now, wait. We have to figure out how can we psych ourselves so that we have... You realize you could be on to one of the great diet secrets of the century.
Right. Well, the more vividly you imagine food in when you're awake, the same thing is actually true. If you can vividly imagine yourself eating something, you actually want to eat less of it. That's been shown as well. So our unconscious doesn't know the difference between reality and fantasy. So the more vividly you can imagine something, it will often believe that you've actually done it.
Unfortunately, my hips do know the difference. But if
right.
I can convince my subconscious, I'm probably in good shape. What is your take on dream dictionaries? I've come across several of them online.
There are so many dream dictionaries out there. And dream dictionaries are just somebody who sat down and said, hey, you know, what would it mean if I dreamed about a table? Well, maybe that means I want to table something. So they're sometimes pretty creative, and they're basically just being made up by somebody out of thin air. So you don't want to put much credence in dream dictionaries. Because, again, our own symbology of our own unconscious, it's so rich and it's so personal.
Sounds like it would be much more fun than a dream date.
Yeah, sure.
Thank you for talking with us, Veronica.
Sure, happy to. Thanks for having me.
Veronica Tonet is a licensed psychologist. Her latest book is The Creative Dreamer. Lines are open. We're taking your calls. That's 800-537-5252. Connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or email us at splendidtable.org. We've got Varsha on the line. She's calling from Richardson, Texas. Varsha, hi.
It's an honor to talk to you, Lynn.
My question
is about baking of fish. Whenever I bake fish, it turns out pretty fine, but only thing is, my problem is, it turns out soggy at the base.
Soggy at the base?
How can I avoid that?
Tell me how you're baking.
At the bottom.
Tell me how you're baking it. Like, is it a deep pan, a shallow pan?
Oh, no. It's just a baking tray. I just line it with a normal baking aluminum sheet.
Right.
And I oil it. And then the marination I use for my fish, usually I cook tilapia. I use a marination like any marination with a vinegar base, like as I use like the normal mustard that we use for sandwiches.
Right.
Yellow mustard and then vinegar.
Right.
Cumin, garlic paste.
Well, this sounds delicious.
Green chili paste and a teaspoon of oil if you want, you can add.
Mm-hmm.
And then rub it on the fish and I marinate it for an hour in the fridge.
Right.
And then I bake it at 380 degrees.
Right.
For about 7 to 9 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then for about 5 minutes, I put it on a high broil.
All right. This is what I think. Do you wipe the marinade off before you put it in?
No.
Well, maybe what you want to do is just wipe the marinade off the side of the fish that's going right directly on the tray. Lightly oil the sheet.
Okay.
But this way, there's nothing wet on the underneath the fish, and in the best of all possible worlds, I'm saying this with fingers crossed, it shouldn't be wet at the bottom. But you may get a tad of sticking. So what you want to have is, you know, something like a pancake spatula that you can slip right under the fish fillet, and that way you can just easily get it out. Try that. I think that's going to solve the problem. And the marinade sounds delicious. I've been making notes as you were talking.
Actually, for fish, if you want, usually kids don't eat it if it smells fishy.
Right.
So always use any kind of marinade that has a little bit of vinegar in it. If you want to avoid vinegar in the food itself, what you can do is put the fish in a bath of one part vinegar and two parts water for about 5 minutes. Rinse it off and then use your regular marinade or anything and then cook the fish. That fishy smell will go away.
That's a great tip.
Yeah.
Varsha, thank you. Thank you very much.
Welcome.
And I
nice
think you'll have a dry bottom fish.
Sure, I will. And I'll email to you if I'm successful.
That would be great.
Thanks,
Varsha,
for your
thank
tip.
You.
Welcome.
800-537-5252. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. And the question is, how can you tell if an egg is cooked or raw without breaking it? We're going to be back with that answer in a moment, and you and I are going to talk some more. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show for people who love to eat. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Now, we're going to be talking with you in a moment, so get in touch. You can connect with us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, email us at splendidtable.org, or actually call 800-537-5252. But first, I have got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how can you tell if an egg's raw or cooked without breaking it? Well, twirl the egg. If it's raw, it wobbles. If it's cooked, it spins. Another salient egg fact is that an eggshell has about 17,000 pores, and the all-time favorite egg trivia, brown eggs come from chickens with brown earlobes. White eggs come from, you know, the rest. Okay, back to your calls. Let's talk. You can reach us at 800-537-5252 or send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Well, let's see. We've got Michelle on the line from New Orleans. Michelle, hi. What's up?
Hi. How are you?
I am good. I am good.
Well, I was calling because I'm planning my wedding for October, and I'm thinking of doing seasoned salt in test tubes as my wedding favors, and I was looking for interesting ideas to do the seasoned salt that would be self-stable and attractive.
Well, first of all, it's very simple to do, as you probably know. Get some coarse sea salt, and often it's called selgris, G-R-I-S.
Okay.
And you can buy it by the pound, and it's generally a lot cheaper than the very fancy sea salts. And the idea would be that you then just pack it with whatever herbs you want. So a classic combination, if you're looking at an Italian kind of thing, would be perhaps rosemary and some lemon zest, you see.
Okay.
Grated lemon zest in there.
Okay, and that would be shelf-stable?
Oh, absolutely, because the idea is you're going to have more salt than herbs and lemon. And salt's a preservative. That's one of the great things about it. Now, another combination, if you wanted to go in a different direction, you could do some sort of hot chili, dry chili, and perhaps even grated ginger, because the ginger, even though it's a fresh product, it's going to be permeated by the salt.
Okay.
So, and I'm just trying to think, one of the lovely combinations is something like dill with nutmeg and black pepper and a lot of salt.
That's different. I've never heard of anything like that.
That's more your Scandinavian angle.
Okay.
And that's wonderful rubbed on fish or on a simple piece of pork that you're going to roast. It's a lovely combination because you know how sweet dill can be, and then black pepper has that kind of spark to it. Boy, you can go. You know, I'm just thinking, I've got a bunch of salts that were given to me. Someone's grandmother in Italy used these, and she had marked the bottles for meat, for fish. She did a combination of thyme and basil and I think oregano that was really good. Here's the trick. Look at recipes you really like and look at the herb combinations in them.
Our theme is kind of herbs, so I'm using sage in my bouquets and decorations. So I was thinking of using sage, but some of the recipes I had seen were for frying the sage before.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Oh, no, you're on the right track. Your instincts are right on. Sage, orange zest. Fabulous. Fabulous. The combination is a winner all the time. No, you just use fresh sage. You're going to fry sage when you're going to eat it on its own. But you don't have to fry sage to mix it up with salt. So tell me, what's he like?
He's a cook, actually, and he loves Cajun. We live in New Orleans, so we're into the pork and Cajun food. So
he cooks in a restaurant?
Yes, he does.
Ah, so, I mean, what does he look like?
He's tall and a big guy. They call him Grizzly at the restaurant. That's his nickname. He's got a big beard, and he's very handsome, in my opinion.
Well, congratulations to both of you. And I think these favors are a great idea because people will really use them and they'll be remembering. Oh, you know what? One last thing. You know, herbs all have meaning. And there's a great tradition of brides giving their guests rosemary because rosemary is the herb of fond remembrance. So
I couldn't remember what the significance of rosemary was, but I knew that there was something to that.
Yeah.
So I like that a lot.
Yeah, and so you could just do rosemary in different combinations. Or take a sprig of rosemary and with a piece of twine, just attach it, a little couple of sprigs, to each one of those test tubes. Wouldn't that be nice?
I love that idea.
It's so romantic,
thank
isn't
you.
It? I mean, and so simple.
May
it be a joyous day and a
Thank
great life.
Thank you so much, Lynn.
You take
Enjoy
care.
Your show.
Bye.
Bye.
By the way, this is kind of great fun, and especially since we're going to be getting into fresh herb season, you can go online and check out the meanings of herbs. And there was a time when people would give each other bouquets of flowers and herbs, because flowers have meaning as well. And you could actually send someone a message with the bouquet you were sending. So whatever's in the center of the bouquet is the main sentiment. And then the surrounding things are sort of the adjuncts to that sentiment. You could say some, shall we say, things that are hard to say face-to-face. Just send a bouquet. Call us, 800-537-5252. Or shoot us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Audrey's on the phone from Collinsville, Connecticut. Audrey, hi.
Hi,
what's
Liz.
Up?
Well, I have an exciting gift I received from my secretary, and I need some help from you in figuring out how to use it. My secretary received from her son-in-law a bottle of balsamic vinegar flavored with espresso, and she gave me about a half a cup of it in a jelly jar.
Uh-huh.
So I have just a wee bit, and I've come up with three ideas so far, but I haven't tried any of them, and I'd love to hear what you think.
Well, what does it taste like?
It's really, it's sweeter than I thought it would be. It's
yeah.
very silky, and it's got, as far as balsamics go, it's got a medium body to it.
And do you taste the coffee?
You do, and you smell it.
Wow.
You smell it when you open the jar. But it also, it has sort of a little bit of a chocolate scent to it. But maybe that's just me, because I do.
I you know, the first thing that comes to mind to me is that put a few drops of it over vanilla ice cream.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the very old balsamic that's almost syrupy and
yep.
very complex is delicious with anything that's sweet, especially anything creamy or fruit,
mm-hmm.
especially if you could imagine. I mean, one of the classics is strawberries, but
right.
stone fruits are wonderful in it. And the other thing that I find is that when you're in the winter with dried fruits,
mm-hmm.
dip dried peaches or dried pears
right.
in it.
Oh, I like that.
But what were the ideas you came up with?
The first place I went was thinking about doing a little drizzle on top of a chicken mole.
Oh.
Because I always put, you know, chocolate in my mole sauce.
Right. I don't know, though, that you may lose it because the
yeah.
mole sauce is so complex.
Right.
Not that it would hurt. But
well,
it sounds
right.
like you know. It sounds like you don't have much, so we've got a husband.
Right,
this,
exactly.
You know?
And then I thought about roasting some whole shallots, sort of caramelizing them, and drizzling it over that, sort of a taste note.
That's brilliant.
On the top.
I think that's brilliant. That would be wonderful.
And then my only other idea was to somehow use it with a salad, but I knew the greens would have to be strong enough to hold up to it. So I thought about a spinach salad with
yeah.
maybe some toasted walnuts.
You know the other thing that would be really good with it in terms of greens? Frisée, curly endive, because they don't have the oxalic acid, and I think I'm using the right term,
mm-hmm.
that spinach tends to have.
Yeah.
But they have this clean, snappy tartness.
Right.
And I think it would bring out that slight bitter edge that the espresso has.
Yeah.
And it's the sweetness would play against them. And you know what else would be wonderful tossed in that salad?
What's that?
Toasted pine nuts.
Ooh.
You're going to have to take out a bank loan to buy these darn things. I mean, they're up to like $20-something a pound.
Oh, I know.
But a small amount of pine nuts and lightly toasted. And you toss that with the vinegar and you need a tad of oil. In fact, you may not even need oil.
Mm-hmm.
This sounds so good. All I'm thinking is you could even take inexpensive balsamic vinegar. I'm thinking of replicating, right,
yeah,
without spending
right.
a fortune. And boil that down with some brown sugar until it's almost syrupy.
Yeah.
Because it gets very rich tasting. And then mix in some strong brewed espresso.
Sure.
Until you get a mix that would make sense. And you could, can you imagine giving that as gifts?
That would be nice.
You know, find little tiny jars so everyone knows it's, you know, you dab it under your behind your ears or you just use a drop. That's it.
Well, I'm hanging on to mine so far.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, but I think it'd be worth trying to replicate it.
Right.
I'd try everything and see what you think and then start making your own.
Okay. Will do.
Hey, thanks for the great idea.
Thank you.
You take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Isn't that a dynamite idea? Look, you know, balsamic is being mixed with everything that you can imagine, right? And the less expensive balsamics, they're not dynamite on their own. But if you boil them down with a bit of brown sugar, you get something that's really delicious and you haven't spent $40 a bottle. And then if you add dried fruit or something like the espresso, that could really be great. Okay. Rebecca posted to us on Facebook that she'd gotten a whole smoked pork jowl and she wanted to know what she could do with it. Now, she was thinking of bean soup, and that's a great idea. But here's the thing about smoked pork jowl. This is a form of something that's selling for a great deal of money called guanciale in Italian. This is, how can I put it? Jowl is bacon, but with even more character and more flavor. And what's really great to do with it is you would take thin shavings of it, not too much, maybe, a half a cup. And you'd saute that in a little bit of olive oil with garlic. And then you could throw any fresh vegetable that you like in there. I mean, green beans, carrots, greens, anything. Saute them. And with the greens until they're wilted. And you season them to taste and serve them. And if it was something like green beans or carrots, until they're cooked through, and you could add a tad of tomato, you could add citrus juice if you wanted. But that deep, rich, smoky quality that that pork jowl gives to the dish is just incredible. And you don't need, as I said, very much of it at all. So that's one way to use it. Another way to use it is to insert little pieces of it into a chicken breast. Just literally with a paring knife, make long slashes into a chicken breast and take thin, thin slices of the pork jowl and insert them into it and then slow bake that. It'll be really great. It'll moisten the chicken breast from the inside out. But the other thing is you get that smoky, rich overtone to it. Really good. So, few ideas of what to do with smoked pork jowl. And Rebecca, thanks. We've got Dan calling from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Dan, welcome.
Hey, Lynn. It's great chatting with you. And it's been a long winter here in Michigan. And every time this spring comes, I always get excited about the first food that we can have. And it's, you know, asparagus is one of them. So I went out to the store. I've got the freshest I could get. But I realize, as I think about even cooking fresh asparagus, there seems to be no consistency. I never know if I'm going to get stringy asparagus or not. And I love to cook it, you know, either on the grill or pan roasted.
Right.
And I like to get that little char, and I'm trying to figure out what the mystery is. How do you keep asparagus from getting stringy? Is it cooking it too long or too high, or is it too thick? Or maybe it's not fresh. I knew you would be able to tell me.
Usually it's the next to last thing you just said. It's too thick.
Okay.
And also, if the asparagus has been sitting around for a while, it tends to lose some of its moisture, so the stringiness is accented. But what you want to lean toward is those pencil slim asparagus.
Okay.
Because those, first of all, you don't need to peel them.
Yeah.
Whereas you like to peel those thicker stalks. And secondly, they just generally aren't very stringy. But the tricky thing with them is they cook in an instant. I mean, you really have to be on top of them. But the other thing I like about them is that generally they cook pretty evenly from top to bottom.
Mm-hmm.
You know how sometimes the tip of a thick asparagus will cook very quickly, and then by the time you get to the thickest part of the stem and you get that where you want it, the tip is really mush, or at least, not nice.
Not good.
So go for the pencil slim asparagus. And they're going to give, if you're on the grill, I would say, a minute or two. Just watch them really closely. And just poke them with a paring knife, and you'll know. You know, you want them a little firm, a bit of crispness.
Right.
And they're going to continue cooking when you take them off the grill. So always take them away from the heat, a few moments ahead of
all
where
right.
you want
them to be. All right, and as far as when you get that first asparagus of the year.
Right.
Like, you know, I always cook them with olive oil, salt and pepper, and maybe sprinkle with a little balsamic vinegar afterwards and Parmesan cheese. But what is the Lynn Rosetta Casper way of the first asparagus of the season? Because everybody wants to know this. That's what they want to know.
And I know they're just hanging on every word, right? I mean, the world has stopped. They're waiting for the
right,
answer.
They are waiting.
Well, I'll be honest. I love doing with them what you do. You know, I like getting them under the broiler or on the grill. I like what happens with the char.
Mm-hmm.
But for the first of the season, I want it absolutely simple. I want to taste the pure thing. So mm-hmm. I'll steam them. Or when I cook my asparagus in water, I put them in a skillet.
Okay.
Because it's easier to know where they are, you know, where they are in cooking.
Sure.
And so I just take a big skillet. I fill it, you know, maybe half filled with water. I throw a little salt in the water. And I drop the asparagus in and I cook them until they're just tender. And then I just take a tongs or I just dump them very gently into a colander, get them out, rinse them with cold water,
mm-hmm.
stop the cooking, and then they get coarse salt and lemon and maybe olive oil. But I want them as pure as the driven snow.
Well, we in Michigan thank you for your asparagus tips.
Dan, thank you. Enjoy the asparagus.
Thanks, Lynn, so much.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can call us anytime you want. Join us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or 800-537-5252. Until next time, let me leave you with this last thought from MFK Fisher. She said, "There's nothing more private than an unbroken egg." Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Now, you're going to find information on nearly everything you heard here today on our website, splendidtable.org. Also at splendidtable.org is the Splendid Table store, where you can find products related to cooking and baking. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with Shubha Bala and Judy Boudreau. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The website is managed by Sarah Lear. Sally Swift is our managing producer. Well, we're going to be back next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. This is APM, American Public Media.
American Public Media.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.